everybody, and welcome to an action-packed, jam-packed, full of fun and laughs edition of the Jim Cornette Experience here on MLWRadio.com. I am indisputably Jim Cornette, and today on the program, Vince Russo is outed as a backstabbing, conniving prick. Big surprise there. And guess who outed him? He did. Plus, the United Kingdom has proven that Americans are not the only people that fall for Trump-like stupidity. We've got viewer mail, a.k.a. cunning comments from the cult of Cornette, all that and more right here on The Experience today. And now here is the man with so much heat, you can fry an egg on his forehead, Mr. Co-host to you, the great Brian Last. Brian, we are going to knock the fuck out of some people today.
We are? I don't have any heat. Who do I have heat with?
Oh, you're a heat fucking magnet. You're wearing red suspenders, as Bobby Eaton used to say. You're just the most unpopular motherfucker. You're about as popular in certain circles as crotch rot.
Well, you know, certain circles that is popular. I mean,
but only in Germany. But I love you because you're just like me. You don't give a shit. You just like to tell the truth and let the chips, as they say, fall where they may.
That's right. That's exactly right.
That's right. Chips? That's exactly right. I've got some chips, but you can't have any. Before we get into the program, and real quick, last week I want to thank Jim Ross once again for being a great guest. We had great feedback on the program. Not as much, honestly, truthfully, as we did the program on Orlando the week before. Still remains the most feedback, emails, Twitter comments, 95% of them positive that we have had. And people say, well, we hate it when he talks politics, but sometimes there's things more important than wrestling. But we had a great talk with Jim Ross on the expanded edition last week, pretty much a 2-hour show. And many people viewed it as a wrestling clinic, both my breakdown and comments on the American Alpha and Revival matches from NXT and also from our discussion with JR on Mid-South Wrestling. And you can hear more of that when we get to the housekeeping today on the Super Summer Sizzler Series tour and all the stuff where I will be appearing with good old JR. You can hear it in person. Tickets on sale now, as they say. The young folks maybe not say that anymore, but we used to back in my day when we actually sold tickets. And you heard, we got to give a plug to wonderful Willie, my good friend Bill Apter. You heard, and I'm hopefully going to hear, a great interview that he just posted that from 40 years ago. Tell the folks about it and where they can hear it if you can.
It's on YouTube. I have to pull up the exact video name that you'd look for. But if you put Bill Apter, Bruno Sammartino in the most recent video, it would come up. It is Bruno sitting next to Bill Apter, I believe, in the dugout at Shea Stadium after his match with Stan Hansen. And it's them watching Inoki versus Ali on the big screen, the closed circuit presentation. And it is Bruno just ripping this match to shreds, just destroying them. Oh, look at Inoki. He's a disgrace. He should be kicked out of the ring. He's not very good. And then he starts ripping on Ali. He starts ripping on everyone involved in it. It's extraordinary. It's just fantastic. hearing Bruno rip it. And the name of the video is Never Before Heard Sammartino and Apter Commentary of Ali vs. Inoki Fight. So put that in your YouTube search engine and pull it up. It is a fun listen just to hear Bill Apter trying to be, you know, down the middle and Bruno just destroying this match that the promotion he worked for put on.
Well, and put that in your search engine and smoke it. But no, and it was a horrible match, but did you get a sense from listening to Bruno that he knew that it had turned into a shoot and that all the shit had basically hit the fan and all the agreements beforehand had fallen out the window? Or was he actually thinking they were working it like that on purpose? Or I guess Bruno, even with wonderful Willie Apter back then, would be kayfabe anyway. But could you divine any wisdom from that of whether he knew or not?
Not particularly, because Bruno's very good at, you know, maybe better than any other wrestler in history.
Yeah.
Standing on that line and not, you know, letting you know what's really going on in his head. He does point out that he was originally offered the match, which is something he has spoken about recently. He spoke about on Dave Meltzer's show about a year ago, year and a half ago. But he just talks about how awful it is. And he talks about how, you know, he doesn't understand what the strategy is. He doesn't know what Inoki's doing, how there's no action. You hear the people in the stadium. That's the other cool thing. You hear them reacting. And by the end of the fight, you hear, whatever, 25,000 people, 30,000 people booing. So it's like
Well, at least, and that's the only, and we're not trying to savage, and the late Muhammad Ali, my hometown compadre, the original Louisville Lip, we're not trying to knock him. It did fall apart, as everybody knows now, in the days going into it, and it ended up being a shoot. And as they used to say in Mid-South Wrestling, whenever a couple guys would almost get into a fight, but not really, one was scared and the other was glad of it. Bruno, as you said, was the greatest ever at walking the line between saying things and still not exposing the business. Imagine, maybe that's why he was one of the greatest ever at drawing money. I don't know. But anyway, go put that in your search engine and listen to that, folks. That is a historic piece. I don't know why. What else does Bill have in his archives, I wonder, that he's waited so long to release? We've released some things. Actually, they weren't released. They escaped. The drive-thru is back open. It was open last week. Or actually, no, it's open this week with new drive-thru episodes. Since my traveling and bronchitis and all that stuff is over with, and we shouldn't be missing any weeks for the foreseeable future, even though Court Bauer continues to give away the MLW VIP memberships practically for nothing. I believe the pittance is the word that I've used most often. But now, in addition to, hold on, let me find this. I got so many notes here because we had so much to talk about today. The show is so busy. But, well, God damn it. I thought I had notes. But basically, you can pay for this shit now by PayPal. It's like you can get it monthly. It's like $2, $1.99 a month. You can pay by PayPal. Pretty soon he's going to be accepting postage stamps, precious metals, and Persian rugs in exchange for cash. And that may come to that also as a result of the United Kingdom's recent decision. But go to MLWradio.com, click on the VIP button where it says Go VIP. You can pay with PayPal. You can promise to pay him Tuesday for a hamburger today. He'll take anything. He's given this shit away. But if you're a VIP, you get the weekly drive-thrus plus all of the archives of the experiences now. This is number 130-something. So literally hundreds of hours of me, more than the human brain should be allowed to absorb of Jim Cornette plus all the other MLW programming. Go VIP. Go VIP. Go VIP. You got to do it. I talked with my friend Steve Sandberg, who is the head honcho, major domo, founder, operator, and manipulator of Figures Toy Company today. And the new figure that has been tweeted about of me, the pictures, the preliminary pictures, fall 2016, folks. Keep watching JimCornette.com and Figures Inc. and all of the wrestling figure outlets that you would normally suppose would have these type of things. It's going to be all over the place. It's going to be the diamond in their new line coming out in the fall. I have a fall line coming out, Brian. I feel like Yves Saint Laurent.
I saw the picture. It looks good. It certainly looks a lot better than that old WWF figure they issued of you.
Oh, that was a fucking rib. Everybody in the WWF line had a jacked up body except me. I was more jacked up than, Yokozuna rather was more jacked up than me, for fuck's sake. They made me fat on purpose. It was a rib. But this is going to be a good one. Figures, Inc., they do some great stuff. So keep watching this space, as they say, and also JimCornette.com for all. I can't even tell you now. I sound like Mean Gene now. I can't tell you. You got to call a hotline. But there's some stuff coming out for this fall and winter season, Christmas season on JimCornette.com at Cornette's Collectibles that folks are going to drop their teeth over, including some incredible videos. This figure, some other surprise stuff. It's going to be insane. So this Christmas season already, start your Christmas Club accounts, folks, because I'm going to have some excellent product on sale at JimCornette.com, as I do right now and on a continuing basis do. I want to thank all of my customers, all seven of them. No, I'm kidding. Let's get into a couple pieces of viewer mail before we start talking about Dickless and his stupidity and all the other stupid things that have happened to crash our global economy in the last week. But we continue. I said last week I was going to have to put off at reading until this week. More of the mail, it's just been pouring in. I'm behind on emails like crazy. But the feedback on the show we did talking about Orlando and the topic of gun control and lack thereof, and what hopefully should be done, could be done, probably won't be done, as long as the Republicans are in office. A gentleman named Jack, I won't give his last name, but gentleman named, because I'm not trying to do this purely for, but it just goes to show that people from a variety of walks of life agreed with what we had to say. Jack says, "Dear Mr. Cornett, I'm a former U.S. soldier. I was in the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan. This week I listened to your podcast and I wanted to say thank you. Thank you for saying what needed to be said. We all have to do our part to make the world a better place. So thank you for doing your part." And this comes from a soldier who has had experience not only using but having these types of weapons used against him, and he knows they have no place on the street in the United States of America in the hands of a bunch of these goddamn amateurs and wannabe fucking John Waynes and cowboys that don't know what the fuck they're doing and couldn't scratch their ass with both hands on the first try. Paul from the UK, and this is pretty eye-opening. Hi, Jim. Firstly, let me say I love the latest experience. Your observations on hunting, Trump, and religion were excellent. I live in Scotland, where 20 years ago we had a mass shooting in a small town called Dunblane. A total lunatic walked into a school gymnasium and started shooting. He had four legally owned handguns, two 9mm Brownings, and two 357 Magnums. This atrocity took 17 lives, 16 children, and one teacher. And then the fuckwit that did this took his own life after mowing down those 17 people. Within a year of this happening, the Prime Minister at the time, John Major, reacting to the Cullen inquiry that inquired, that advised tighter gun laws in the UK, brought in a law that banned all cartridge-loading handguns except single-shot 22s. After a general election in the UK, the new Prime Minister, Tony Blair, took it one step further and banned all handguns, leaving only musket-loading and historical handguns being legal. Since this atrocity in 1996, there has not been another mass shooting of this kind in the UK. This is an example of the government taking public opinion and trying to ensure that nothing like this happens again. As you have said previously, I know how this is not possible in the US due to the way that the government is run, but how can a leader of a country, leader in quotation marks, be able to do his job if he has to go to a group of people that he has not selected and ask for permission to do something? It is amazing that anyone can look at what has happened in Orlando and not want to get rid of all the weapons that people have. Thank you, Paul. And one more quickly from Andrew in Melbourne, Australia. Andrew says, "I'm not an American, just a mere Australian who can certainly comment on the situation after the Port Arthur massacre, which was nearly 20 years ago and forced lawmakers to rethink their approach to gun safety. I would like to recall some facts on the restriction, not ban, let's be accurate, of firearms in my country. The entire law change on all governmental levels was done in 3 months. The law changes were done by our conservative politicians. One state government fell as a result, but they felt vindicated by the effect of the changes. No mass shootings in 20 years. The federal government that was panned for introducing the changes against their base, mind you, was returned to government the following election and served another 3 full terms. Some of the most ardent opponents of gun control in Australia have changed their minds in the wake of the overwhelming success of the measures and now believe it was the correct and responsible response. Shooting and outdoor sports were minimally affected by the changes, giving semi-automatic weapons aren't really needed to kill a duck or some clay. There are some who still argue, but every place has the bottom of the gene pool. The prevailing opinion here is that the idea of needing so many weapons to combat so many weapons is like eating twice as much McDonald's to lose weight. A gun buyback there would be offset by a lack of carnage in hospitals and needing more police to hold back the nonsense events that happen due to poor firearm education and lack of oversight on things designed to kill. P.S. Donald Trump scares the rest of the world to death. A man with no experience, no life experience outside a certain bubble, a dangerous habit of sweeping statements, and such a phony manner is not fit to govern. The gun per head rate here is higher than in the United States, but the licensing laws and restrictions still manage to keep dangerous people away from weapons. They are made to kill and harm. The laws kill and harm. The laws reflect the potential danger. And lastly, his last point, pretty sure killing is a no-no in most religious texts. Not all now, mind you, but we don't want to get the Muslims upset again because they're taking enough abuse as it is. But, I mean, you know, God was a pretty vengeful God in the Bible, right? I don't know, but and you're one of the Jewish folks, Brian, which I know little about. Where does your religion stand on killing people in the name of the Lord?
On behalf of the Jewish folks, I will say that, you know, you're not supposed to.
Okay. Really, well,
yeah. My religious training ended at my bar mitzvah. And since then, I've just been.
That's because Russo booked it. Yeah. And we've told that story and we'll tease it there, folks. If you'd like to hear the story again of how Vince Russo booked a non-finish at Brian Last's bar mitzvah, send us email to. And what's that email address? That angry email address?
The angriest email in professional wrestling. Cornette@MLW.com.
And that's where all the questions for the drive-thru go. And also, if you want to hear on the experience, Brian Last's bar mitzvah story. We got so much news to talk about. Last week, what I thought was going to be the big news story of the week, the Democratic sit-in for a gun control vote turned out to not be the big story, so we're going to gloss over it here and not give it the attention it deserves, which is basically what the Republicans did. The Democrats in the House finally had enough and said, we want just a vote on two bills that would basically prevent, make illegal and or require further background checks on people buying semi-automatic assault rifles, whatever the fuck you want to call them. I've had people say, well, there's no such thing as an automatic rifle. Well, I don't know these things because I'm a normal fucking human. But they wanted just a vote. And they knew, of course, that the Republicans who were in the NRA's pocket and that fucking fuck twit Wayne LaPierre, what do they call him in Scotland? A cock splat and a twat waffle, that, you know, that he's paid him off. But then they could go around and say, hey, guess what? The Republicans voted against lunatics and terrorists being allowed to purchase guns legally. But the Republicans wouldn't allow it. Even with the sit-in and the chanting and the protesters outside the Capitol, they would not do their job. These cowardly fucks had to pass a bill. This was more important, Brian, than seeing that all these weapons of war get in the hands of lunatics and terrorists. They had to pass a bill saying that financial advisors didn't legally have to be working in the best interest of their clients. That passed. While all this din and falderall is going on around them, they passed that bill. And that no good. And then the coward slunk out in the dark without doing anything to get people from being killed. That fucking Paul Ryan sets a new standard for assholes. You can tell he looks like Eddie Munster when he grew up anyway. But he is just a piece of shit. And they didn't want to vote once again because people could be reminded in November that they voted against keeping these dangerous weapons. So I just off the top of my head, I just tried right before we went on the air. I just tried to sketch out a list. Here is what, folks, the Republicans are against. They are against any form of gun control. They're against abortion rights. They're against the Environmental Protection Agency and any oversight of the environment or any addressing of climate change solutions. They are against the FDA and the oversight of our food to make sure it's not poisoned and our water and et cetera. They're against oversight of Wall Street. They're against raising the minimum wage so that we with jobs that pay at least above the minimum wage do not have to subsidize with our tax money people working full time at Walmart, the members of the family of Walmart that have as much money as the bottom 75 million or so people in the United States of America. That's 10 people versus 75 million. We got to subsidize their employees because if they work at Walmart, they still have to go on fucking welfare or food stamps to be able to pay for their living. So we're contributing every time we pay taxes to the government, folks. Thanks to the Republicans, we are contributing to the Walton family. Those rich cocksuckers. The Republicans also against student debt relief. They want to keep our kids in debt as long as possible. They're against gay marriage and all forms of gay rights. And most of all, they're against health care because they figure if more poor people fucking die, that'll be fewer people that can vote against them. Although somehow they manage to convince many poor people to vote against their own self-interest and vote Republican. So no sane, rational human being can be against all of those things unless they're being paid to be. So we need to remember that in November and try to get some of these fuckers out of the way so we can actually do something. If we make it to November, because before I get into the United Kingdom and friends, and you are my friends, I've been around you too long.
Yeah.
I got a lot of friends. I love the United Kingdom, except when they took about $40,000 out of, as Vince McMahon would say, out of my ass Friday and Monday. But let's talk about a couple of positive things real quickly. The Super Summer Sizzler Series Tour continues. Saturday, July 16th, Sunday, July 17th, it's Oklahomania. We talked about it last week with Jim Ross on Saturday night at Fire Lake Arena in Shawnee. Sunday, all day, the convention, OklaCon, and then the live card at the Cox Convention Center in Oklahoma City. At one or both events, Sting, Jim Ross, Matt and Jeff Hardy, Jerry Jarrett, Jerry Lawler, MVP, Hacksaw Duggan, stars from Ring of Honor, TNA, NWA. Go to ImperialWrestlingRevolution.com and find out how you can make a whole weekend out of it, because it's the biggest wrestling extravaganza in Oklahoma since the days of Mid-South Wrestling. And I haven't been there in 20 years, so I'm looking forward to being there. Somewhere I have been recently and am going back to, Louisville, Kentucky, my hometown, Friday, July 29th and Saturday, July 30th for Fandom Fest this year at the Kentucky Fair and Exposition Center. It'll be Stan Lee's final appearance in Louisville, Thursday through Sunday, August 4th through 7th, the Charlotte Fan Fest. Folks, go to NWALegends.com. JR talked about this last week. He's going to be executive producer of the new film that's being started, 605. About not your podcast now, Brian, but the legendary days of TBS wrestling. But there's going to be the Hall of Heroes banquet where they're inducting the Road Warriors, Dusty Rhodes, Handsome Jimmy Valiant. There's going to be live Q&As. Jim Ross is going to do his ringside event. I'm going to do the experience, a roast of Ole Anderson over the weekend, live matches. It's the greatest weekend of the summer. You got to come to the Charlotte Fan Fest and meet your childhood heroes and some folks that should have been, and you'll find out. You'll meet them, and they're so nice, you're going to wish you loved them when you were kids. And real quickly, Saturday, August 27th, Gold Rush 3, presented by APWA in the city of Shinston, West Virginia. I'm going to be there with the Rock and Roll Express, the Powers of Pain, and more. And then, of course, the opening date, as it stands now, of the Fall Brawl Tour will be two nights in Baltimore, my old hometown. Hopefully all the Ring of Honor fans will come and tell me what I did wrong, apparently. Friday night, September 23rd, at Jimmy's Famous Seafood in Baltimore, which I understand is the best food that we're ever going to have. Ringside, an evening with Jim Ross and Jim Cornette. Tickets are on sale now. It's an 8 o'clock bell time, as they say. Doors open at 6:30. There's VIP and general admission tickets available. I'm going to plan to try to meet everybody I can. It's an intimate event. There's only a couple hundred tickets. They're going to go fast if they haven't already. So go to mcwprowrestling.com, mcwprowrestling.com. And then the following day in Joppa, right outside Baltimore at the MCW Arena, Pro Wrestling Tribute to the Legends Convention, Bret Hart, Jimmy Hart, Jim Neidhart, the Hart Foundation back together, plus Howard Finkel, Honky Tonk Man, Hillbilly Jim, Greg Valentine, Paul Orndorff, myself, Jim Ross, a host of others. Cowboy Bob Orton's going to be there. So that's on September 23rd and 24th in and about Baltimore. You got to be there. And I mentioned last week, Kayfabe Commentaries, the newest timeline release is 1986 with the Rock and Roll Express, and that is still on sale at shootinterviews.com, or you can get it the video on demand. But also, they've just released something this week, and they've achieved a new low in shoot programming. Brian, have you heard about this? Have you read about this?
I don't know what you're talking about. No,
a new low in programming. You shoot with the little bastard himself, Swoggle, formerly Hornswoggle, but they hornswoggled him out of his name, so now he's Swoggle. But I'm reading verbatim because I'm not trying to be, well, it wouldn't be racist, it'd be sizist, but he may be smaller in stature, but he's big enough to agree to open up on you shoot. Join Swoggle as he fields your questions about everything from Vince McMahon to the Muppets. This guy may be known as a bully to some, but he certainly learns to laugh at himself through the course of this appearance, especially as he begins to realize a bunch of the questions are coming from the boys with whom he spent his time in a certain large federation. I wonder where that could be. All the inside jokes that the boys have sent in to try to rattle him on camera, plus the U Shoot games are there too. They play the hoe bag. I didn't do this on U Shoot. I apparently took the high road, but to measuring up, you ever wonder where Swoggle stacks up against Hervé Tattoo Villachez or Peter Dinklage? Well, they're going to measure all those folks. It's highbrow entertainment in low places. Can you stand to hear what's going to go on with Swoggle on You Shoot? It's shootinterviews.com, kayfabe commentaries. Another Back to the Territories coming out soon. They're just pumping this stuff out. It's the finest shoot programming in the land, folks, and we love it. And speaking of the finest programming in the land, if you have time after you listen to all that, check out the 605 Super Podcast.
The 605 Super Podcast, the best wrestling podcast on the planet. We had a packed show last week. Hey, people went crazy over it.
I'm only going to not take exception to that because I don't consider this a wrestling podcast. I consider this my experience. So just so you know.
Okay, well, there you go. I stand by the best wrestling podcast on the planet, the 605 Super Podcast, the mothership. Last week on the show, we had a packed show. People went crazy for part three of our talk with AWA producer Polish Joe Chupik. We get all the details about the end of the AWA, the death of the AWA, and the rebirth as a pay-per-view entity. We get the inside scoop of what exactly was in the AWA tape catalog that now Vince McMahon owns. Polish Joe knows it better than anyone. He went through every single bit of footage they have, so we get to hear exactly what's in that catalog, as well as the story about Jesse Ventura coming back to the AWA for a tour of the studio in order to help negotiate a better contract with Vince McMahon. That's on the show. Jim Cornette is on the show talking about the Cincinnati Gardens, which is soon to be demolished. A really fun talk, as well as Gypsy Joe. And on the topic of Gypsy Joe, Bobby Fulton of the Fantastics came on the show to talk about Gypsy Joe, as well as being in a rare position of both seeing as a kid and later wrestling Wild Bull Curry. A fantastic show. This week on the show, we have a long and incredible interview with Richard Vajcic. Richard is the author of the new book, Bruiser, the biography of Dick the Bruiser on Scott Teal's Crowbar Press.
I have read it. It's wonderful. My childhood hero, maybe my first favorite wrestler, Dick the Bruiser.
And I think we should talk about this a little bit more in a second here. But let me just say, check this out. It is a fascinating interview, a fascinating discussion. For those of you who knew Dick the Bruiser, who saw Dick the Bruiser, you will love this. If you don't know much about him,
if you don't know Dick, this is the book to own.
Listen to my show this week and you will know Dick after you're done. But anyway, 605 Super Podcast, 605pod.com. It is on iTunes. It is on Stitcher. It is everywhere you can illegally download a file. It is there, as well as the Facebook page, facebook.com/superpodcast.
And also, and when I talk about the Cincinnati Gardens, also, I won't spoil the details on it for people who haven't heard the show yet, but I will talk about the infamous time when I shared a bathroom stall in the Cincinnati Gardens with Star Maker Bolan. We were both in there together. For what reason, I will leave it up to you to listen to the show and find out.
You can find out all about Dick this week.
Yes.
The Super Podcast. You know, Jimmy, did you see the artwork?
When I went in the bathroom, I said, is this where all the dicks hang out? And, you know, yes. And I saw the artwork that Travis Bickle from Taxi Driver, perpetrated some artwork of me and Bolan in the stall together at the Cincinnati Gardens. And boy, and it looked quite like us. I will say that.
He's got the hair.
Yeah, but I had more hair then. But before we talk about the UK and our friend, Mr. Stoogifying himself, Mr. Stoogification Vince Russo, you had a couple of show-related topics also that you wanted to delve into.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's start with talking about Dick the Bruiser. You know, I know that he is one of the first people you saw in wrestling, someone who, you know, you were able to get that TV at Indianapolis. And, you know, until I read the book, I didn't realize – you know, I knew he was one of the biggest stars of all time, which is amazing considering he had a very limited run in the Northeast leading up to that riot in 57, which was one of the biggest stories ever. A very limited run in Los Angeles, despite the fact that he was the WWA champion out there for a while. His career is all Midwest, yet he's still one of the biggest stars ever, even though the magazines weren't really there.
He never worked Texas. I won't say never with a guy that was in the business as long as Bruiser, but never for any length of time did he work Texas. Never for any length of time did he work Florida. Never for any length of time was he in Canada. yet he was still a top 10 box office attraction for literally years and years, and one of, at the time, the biggest stars in the business. And it all was due to the fact that Chicago, and first the network television, and then Jim Barnett's huge Midwest territory, and the fact that he was a fly-in guy, he got over so well that he was able to fly in and make main event shots in a variety of territories, and then go right back home. And he was seen every once in a while in these territories, and it was a treat when it happened. So he sold a bunch of tickets.
And, you know, it's really interesting, his career, because he gets involved in wrestling. He really starts, for the most part, the end of 54. By early 56, he already has an NWA title shot against Lou Thesz. He's already a main event guy that quickly. He's already on the letterhead, on the envelopes that come out of Fred Kohler's Chicago wrestling office. I mean, he was that big a star instantly. And very quickly, by the early 60s, he realized that he wanted more than that. He wanted some protection. And he did a few different things at that time. He first, with Wilbur Snyder, started a company and ran opposition to Jim Barnett and Bach Estes, and won the war, won a promotional war against Jim Barnett
in Indianapolis. And now let's, with an asterisk there, there wasn't much of a war, because at the time Barnett got the opportunity, because Barnett was he owned the huge Midwest territory. He had worked in Fred Kohler's office and got his start in wrestling that way in Chicago in the 50s. But he landed the opportunity through some political connections to go to Australia and open up the original World Championship Wrestling. And Qantas Airlines was a sponsor at that time. The guys, it was the biggest, not only the geographically biggest, but also the best paying wrestling territory in the world, probably in the 60s. And so he went with that, and kind of the story I always got was that he basically surrendered and said, I'm headed for higher ground, and I'm going for a more profitable place anyway. And he made money over there. But the deal was that Sheik would buy the Detroit end from him, and Bruiser and Snyder would buy Indianapolis. And I always heard that Sheik paid him every penny, even though he was an Australian, couldn't do anything about it, and he never heard from Bruiser and Snyder again. And then Bruiser and Snyder wanted to run Detroit and Michigan in that area, but since Sheik had bought it from him, and Sheik was ensconced in that area because that was his hometown, they had to back out of that. And it wasn't until 1971, when they started the war up there, that they went back to Michigan and Ohio.
Well, you got to remember, Dick the Bruiser, before the Sheik, was the big star in Detroit. He put wrestling at the Olympia on the map. I mean, even after he retired, he was a big star in Detroit. He was on, you know, radio there. That, you know,
oh, yeah.
Imitated his voice. He was a major star there. And that's one of the things I really found fascinating about the book, Jim, that I didn't really know, is Dick the Bruiser's here, and you think of Indianapolis, you think of Chicago, but one of the other towns you really think of is St. Louis, which is just the home of the NWA. It's Sam Mushnick's St. Louis. And he's a major star in St. Louis for over 20 years. Meanwhile, he goes to war against the Sheik, an NWA promotion in Detroit. He is a part of a group with Vern Gagne that attempts to take over Los Angeles in the 60s from the LaBelles, which, you know, is something I really didn't know too much about until I read the book. And then, of course, he went, you know, to war with Jim Barnett. I mean, like you said, it wasn't really a big war, but they ran opposition and they survived in the end.
And he was partners with Vern Gagne in Chicago, which for a lot of the 60s and early 70s was one of the biggest drawing wrestling cities in the country, and still managed to be best friends and the top draw, one of the top draws, for the president of the NWA in St. Louis, Sam Mushnick, even though Sam couldn't use him during the time he was waging the war with the Sheik in Detroit. Mushnick couldn't bring him in, but as soon as the war was over with and Bruiser and Sheik had settled their business and started working together again, then Sam brought him back. I've got some of the old payoff sheets from the St. Louis Ledger Club, or St. Louis Wrestling Club, the Ledgers. And even in the early 80s, when Bruiser would challenge, and this was like a time warp match, 30 years almost after his debut in wrestling, Bruiser was still selling out the Kiel Auditorium or the big shows at the Checker Dome, challenging Ric Flair or Harley Race for the NWA Championship. And back in those days, in the late 70s, early 80s, a sellout house in St. Louis meant the NWA champion and his opponent got payoffs between $5,000 and $6,000 each for that one night. And that's in the early 80s. And I have the Ledger book copies to testify to that. So once again, for people who think Vince McMahon brought in big money in wrestling, what would $6,000 bucks be for in 1982 now? Probably over 15, close to 18. We're talking, you know, a pay-per-view payoff type of thing just for challenging for the NWA title and drawing a big house in St. Louis.
Yeah, and that match against Ric Flair, they both got close to a $6,000 payday. Coincidentally, that was Ric Flair's bar tab that night in St. Louis.
All right.
You know, Jim, on the topic of things we've talked about on 605, I kind of want to get your opinion about something. We did a what if. We do these what if segments that the listeners really like. And the one I did the other day was, what if Hulk Hogan had not left the AWA, which, of course, is one of the biggest things to happen in wrestling history. And you can look at it from the AWA side. If Hulk Hogan doesn't leave, that means Gene Okerlund doesn't leave right then. That means David Schultz doesn't leave. Potentially Bobby Heenan doesn't leave. Potentially there's a whole bunch of things that go into play. But I tried to look at it from the other side. Vince McMahon had begun his national expansion in 1983. He had gone into Georgia Championship Wrestling Towns, gone head-to-head with Ole. He got on cable television. He made his moves to try to buy the AWA and then, you know, eventually would go to war with the AWA. Lots of different things happen. But we know that in 1984, he wasn't going to go forward with Bob Backlund. He did not want Bob Backlund as his main guy. We also know he couldn't rely on Jimmy Snuka, despite the fact he was the most popular guy in the company. So the question we asked on the show is, who would Vince McMahon have gone with to go national with 1984 forward? Who would have been his top star? And I would like to get your thoughts. I'm going to name a couple people, and if you have anyone else you could throw in there, let us know what you think. But we said,
well, and first I'll say that's a very good question, and I'm drastically searching for someone that would have fit Vince McMahon's concept of wrestling at the time. So throw some names at me, because you know, that was one of those things where how could you replace that one guy?
I'm going to throw three names at you. They're all different, and they all come with a little, you know, carrot at the end of it. Sergeant Slaughter, who would turn babyface shortly after the beginning of 1984 and become, you could argue, either number two or number three to Hulk Hogan in terms of popularity. It's either Hogan, Snuka, Slaughter, or Hogan, Slaughter, Snuka. So maybe you turn Slaughter babyface early, and you still get that same storyline with an American beating the Sheik for the title. Or Kerry Von Erich. We know Vince was really hot after the Von Erichs. We know he attempted to have a merger of sorts with Fritz Von Erich. We know that when he went to war with everyone, the Von Erichs were in his magazine. They were mentioned on his television show. They were profiled on All American Wrestling in 83. He definitely wanted, and knowing what he likes in a wrestler,
yeah,
he certainly would have wanted Kerry Von Erich on top of everyone. And then the one I threw out there is someone who would have been, I think, great in the role, but I don't think he would have done it because of the travel, Austin Idol.
Ooh, very interesting. I'm going to take the Sarge. If they had turned Sarge babyface earlier and he had beaten the Sheik, the evil Iranian, for the title, that would have been a big wrestling angle. And Sarge was one of the best big men, one of the best workers in the business, and he could cut a promo. And obviously, the way that he did end up getting over, and then the only reason that he left working for Vince was because he got the G.I. Joe spot, and you know, Vince wanted either a piece or all of that, and Sarge didn't want to give it to him. That's where they had their falling out. But it would have been a major wrestling angle and done great wrestling business. But it wouldn't have been Slaughter Mania,
right?
With Austin Idol, I'll jump to your pick first. He would have been a better promo than Hogan was at the time. He had that superhero look. Personally, and I can't see Austin Idol and Vince McMahon coexisting in the same place at the same time with Idol doing what Vince wanted him to do, and that concept of wrestling, it would not have lasted very long at all. Let's put it that way.
And to your previous point, there wouldn't have been a Slaughter Mania. There was an Idol Mania before there was Hogan Mania.
And there once again, there could have been if you took Hulk Hogan's, I don't even want to say brain. If you took Hulk Hogan's personality and willingness to do things a certain way and put it in Austin Idol's body, it still could have worked. But those two personalities would not have coexisted. And out of the three that you mentioned, Kerry Von Erich, once again, he would have been the pick. He looked the part. He was certainly a better worker even then than Hogan was. He couldn't talk, but he might not have had to have with the McMahon's machine behind him. But once again, that we wouldn't be standing here probably right now. At least wrestling history would have been radically different, because it would have probably been red hot for two or three years. And then Kerry, something would have happened because of the things that happened with the boys, it would have probably happened quicker with that amount of money and that amount of travel and that amount of adulation on the line. And then if Vince had put all his eggs in that basket, he probably would have gone out of business.
And, you know, the other interesting thing is, you know, Cyndi Lauper would have still happened because that was through Lou Albano that happened. And that led to MTV, which was Richter versus Moolah. But Vince wouldn't have been as instantly successful going into the Midwest and specifically Minnesota if Vern still had Hogan, if Vern still had Gene Okerlund doing the promos and Bobby Heenan and Ventura and all the guys who defected. If there was a way to stop any of that, and certainly Hogan's the big one. Hogan going over there is really what changed the tide. If that wouldn't have happened, he wouldn't have been as successful in the Midwest.
And there were two other guys, obviously, that we can't ignore that could have been the biggest star in wrestling. And at one time, you know, were Dusty Rhodes and Ric Flair, but neither one of them would have worked in that spot simply because for Flair to have been Flair and to have been useful, Vince would have had to change the entire way that he thought about and presented wrestling. He wouldn't have been able to do sports entertainment. He wouldn't have been able to do the cartoon bullshit and the 8-minute match and it's a personal appearance in tights. He would have had to change up and down the card the way he did everything because Flair would have had to have gone out and get over like Flair does by being the best wrestler in the world and competing against the best. And I don't think Vince would have done that. And Dusty had more of a sports entertainment mindset, and he could, and it obviously would tailor his style to the WWF style, which he did later on in his career. And he could definitely have, of all of the people that we mentioned, he was by far the best promo. But Vince would have had to change the way that he looked at a guy. Would he have put Dusty Rhodes physically as the figurehead of his promotion, even though Dusty could talk him in the building? And then you would have had some blood, and you'd had to have some violence, and you'd have to have the Dream out there fiery, wanting revenge and cutting those promos, and people would have had to believe it. And so Vince would have had to change again to put Dusty in that spot, who, if Vince had changed and done Dusty's thing, Dusty could have probably fit very well in that spot and would have drawn. There's no other person that I could think of that could have had the collaboration with Vince McMahon that Hogan did, and that Vince wouldn't have had to have changed his concept or presentation of what he thought wrestling was to change for that star.
You know, Dusty's an interesting one because Dusty was, of all the guys we've named, the biggest national star.
Yeah.
He
drew in Madison Square Garden. For Vince Sr.
Do you think, knowing both of them, specifically knowing Dusty shortly after this time, do you think Dusty would have been able to, at that point in the 80s, coexist with a Vince McMahon who has an idea for the way he wants things presented and done?
Well, like I said, Vince would have had to have changed a lot just because Dusty wasn't going to look like Hulk Hogan physically. I think Dusty could have probably changed a little bit. But at the same time, I didn't know Dusty till 84. Dusty in the late 70s was so hot and so popular. And Dusty Mania was nuts, even though it wasn't called that. It just the fact that he was the most popular guy in the business at one point. I don't know if Dusty and Dream the Ego, baby, were the biggest Texas. And I don't know if he would have felt like he was the one that needed to change at that point or whether the promoter needed to change, because why would you change something that had worked everywhere it went for Dusty? So it might have been one of those situations where Dusty and Vince, one of the others said to him the same thing that Bill Watts said to Vince when he left in 95. There's only room for one Titan in Titan Sports. So... Really, if not for, I think, well, son of a bitch, Vince ought to be horsewhipped for firing Hulk over his sex tape revelations, because if it wasn't for Hulk Hogan, Vince McMahon might be still running the Cape Cod Coliseum up there and Linda'd be taking in washing. Who knows?
Who knows? But it's more fun discussions like this that you could hear on the 605 Super Podcast.
Well, and every once in a while, you can hear him here, too. And we're going to have some fun in a minute with an old friend of mine, and I'm sure he's one of yours, ladies and gentlemen, Vince Fuckwad Russo. But real quick, you know, I was going to do a whole show on this because I was so mad over the weekend, but at this point, I just want to review And it's a cautionary tale, ladies and gentlemen. Everybody knows, and for the UK fans that we've got out there, and we've got a bunch of them, and I met them 2 years ago when we did the Corny in the UK tour, and I said then, and I say again, the UK fans, if anything, were more polite and more accommodating and more knowledgeable even than a lot of the fans here in this country. And I loved my sightseeing. I loved the countryside. I loved Scotland. We went to Glasgow. We rode the trains. We were in the cars. I didn't like driving on the wrong side of the road because I'm freaked out a lot at that. But I loved my time over there, and great people and great places and wonderful scenery. And London was fantastic. And boy, did you guys fuck the world last week. Brexit. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, you're one of the low information voters that either needs to just vote Democrat, because I tell you to, or stay away from the goddamn polls this November, because Jesus Christ, the United Kingdom, and I am not going to pretend to be as well versed on European and UK politics and the European Union as I am here in the United States, but there had to be a better way. Cutting your nose off to spite your face, as they say, is not necessarily the right. And I know there were some people upset at the European Union. They're having laws being governed by someone that's not elected in another part of the country or another part of the continent. But the European Union grew out of a dream of Winston Churchill's. After he, who had seen and served in two world wars that started in Europe, saying this could not happen again, because with the rise of atomic weapons, and he didn't even realize nuclear weapons would be a part of things, another world war could be the end of mankind on the face of the planet. And he had a dream that there would be, and he called it this, a United States of Europe. And it started slow, but much like the Who's down in Whoville, it continued to grow. And even if the execution has been bad, the concept was correct in that a European Union with free movement and free trade and a lack of borders amongst those countries, it's not that Europe is not like the United States. It's not a country with another country up top and one country down below and oceans on each side. It's literally a couple of dozen countries on the same continent who didn't have a great history of coexisting with each other. So the European Union, in theory, was a good thing, but there have been problems. When I was over there in 2014, Scotland was either about to take a vote or just had taken a vote, I can't remember which, about whether they wanted to remain in the United Kingdom or whether they wanted to be independent. And there were people and points for each side, but the vote, as I heard it, they remained in the United Kingdom because they still wanted to be a part of the European Union. That is no longer the case. After the vote that nobody thought was going to happen last week, the pollsters, the markets were betting on it. Everybody thought this can't happen. The economists have told the people of the UK what will happen. Cooler heads will prevail. The vote was there simply to give everybody their democratic right, but it, the betting odds, the smart money, was that they were going to stay in the European Union. And the smart money didn't carry it, and they voted themselves out. And it just, I want to just remind the people, in case they don't, they're not news junkies like me, here's what happened in one 24-hour period because of the vote of the people in the United Kingdom to leave the European Union. Over $2 trillion worldwide from the global stock markets was evaporated in one day. The pound fell to a 35-year low. The world markets in the developed countries, at least, were down anywhere from 3% to 12%. The Dow Jones dropped 600 points in one day. The United Kingdom is headed into, everybody still believes, a recession. The United Kingdom dropped from the fifth largest to sixth largest economy in the world. The Prime Minister, Cameron, resigned and gave his notice and said he's done in October. A potential global recession is still on the horizon. The jury's out on that. The resolution of how to extricate the United Kingdom from the European Union will take a minimum of 2 years. Some experts are saying the repercussions will be felt for a decade. And the day that that was happening, ladies and gentlemen, the presumptive Republican nominee for president of the United States, leader of the free world, was in Scotland at his golf club and had a press conference. And he led with the story of, look at the renovations we've done on the hotel. The suites are beautiful.
Yeah, look at the light tower.
Look at the light tower. Then he congratulated Scotland for taking their country back, obviously ignorant and oblivious to the fact that Scotland had voted to remain, and they are mad at the United, at the rest of, at England and Wales for getting them out of the European Union and maybe calling another vote to decide whether they want to secede from the United Kingdom. So he's congratulating these fucking people on losing what they wanted in the election and didn't know the difference. This is the guy that wants to be president of the United States.
I was watching it.
This money-grubbing little asshole that wants to be president of the United States that doesn't even know enough about foreign policy to know how the country that he's standing in at the time voted.
I was watching it live when it happened. It was, you know, every network cut into it, not realizing he was going to just promote his properties as opposed to talk about the biggest story globally in years. And the funniest thing was, it was such a shit show from beginning to end, but some heckler stood up. And it took them forever to get to him. And he just goes, "Excuse me, Mr. Trump, I'm so sorry. I forgot to pass these out for you.
I'm so sorry.
And he has golf balls with swastikas on them.
And he dumped them, and they didn't even realize they left him lay there for like 20 minutes before. Yeah. You know, this is, as Elizabeth Warren, who, by the way, should be the first woman president of the United States and hopefully will be Hillary Clinton's running mate, because I love her. She is fucking great. I will vote for Elizabeth Warren to do anything, anytime. She says exactly what he is. He's a fucking phony and a con man and a bully and a charlatan and a snake oil salesman who waits for financial crises like this so that he can snatch up property at a minimum. And he's like a succubus. He draws his strength from other people's misery. He makes his money off other people's hardship. This is the guy that some people in the United States want to run this country. And not only are the rest of the people in the United States terrified, but the entire world is terrified that if this vote can happen in England, that Trump could get elected. And then where the fuck would we all be? Because we still don't know whether the United States is going to be thrown into a recession as a result of this boneheaded move. And I'm sorry, some people tweeted me, "Well, I'm sorry that you lost your money, but we have our freedom," or whatever the fuck. No, I didn't lose $3 trillion, motherfucker. The whole world did. People lost their retirement, lost out of their retirement funds or their kids' college funds or their investments for their homes or whatever the case may be. Everybody lost money. Especially in the United Kingdom. Did I mention the pound is at its lowest point now in probably 40 years and a recession looms? They don't even know who's going to be running the country that's going to be doing the negotiations to get out of the European Union. And they were sold a bill of goods. Hashtag what have we done was trending in Europe on Twitter. They were sold a bill of goods, a very Trump-like bill of goods. It's such a parallel. It's ludicrous. We want the whole take our country back. Take our country back was, and at least over there, they did take a country back from something. Over here, we got nothing to take it back from. It hasn't been anywhere. It's still fucking been here, except in the Cro-Magnon, caveman, Neanderthal, Paleolithic period, fucking tiny little fucking BB brains of the people who would support a lunatic and a charlatan and a con man and a fraud and a phony and a money grubber and a fucking carpetbagger like Donald Trump, who not only might crash our economy and send the whole world into fucking crisis on top of this UK debacle, but might very well get us into a nuclear war, because his idea of foreign policy is to say, fuck everybody else. We're just going to worry about us. It's a global world now. You can't do that. As we've just found out by the Brexit vote, everybody, whether we want to be or not, is interconnected. This is like a global chain match with, or a strap match with Wahoo McDaniel, or a chain match with Boris Malenko. We're strapped together. We are strapped together, folks. We can't get out of this just so simply. And so think before you do these things. And it's very Trump-like what happened in the UK. It could happen to us unless we use this as a cautionary tale. The market, the Dow here in America, dropped another 300 points on Monday. As we record this on Tuesday, it's rebounded a little, but this is going to be a period of heavy volatility. We don't know what's coming. But with a globalized economy and a globalized world, it's just not as simple as building a fucking wall If you build a 20-foot wall, somebody's going to build a 21-foot ladder. Or somebody's going to dig a fucking hole. But it's more about that. It's about the fact that every economy in the civilized world now depends on not only their own country, but other markets that they have agreements with to sell and to trade goods. And when something like this happens and they pull out of – it's never happened before that a country pulled out of the European Union – There's going to be shit hit the fan until it's all figured out, and that could take years. Brian, you may live to see the resolution of this. I may not.
Yeah, I hope so. It's certainly, taking a little bit of a hit on my portfolio, but that's, like you said, that's a minor problem.
You can afford it, but I can't. Yeah, because, you got all that money from that lawsuit where you sued the stork that brought you for carrying dope.
What?
But no, but anyway, so I would be interested in if all of the Cult of Cornet members in the United Kingdom would write in and try to tell us what the fuck's going on over there and give us some hope over here in the colonies. Should we get to our main event story today? Because this is so it'll cheer me up. That's why I saved it for last, folks, because I needed to be cheered up after the chaos of the political and geopolitical strata over the weekend. Vince Russo has stooged himself off again. This was a video from his podcast, right?
Yes, it was his podcast, and they do, I guess, a video version of it so you could actually see the people talking.
Because I saw much of it. I couldn't take listening to that fucking voice or looking at that goddamn brown puckered sphincter of a fucking face for like 17 minutes that it was. So I watched some of it and then I was going to go back to it. And by that time it had been taken down because he'd realized what he'd done. But basically, for the folks who don't know, Vince Russo on his podcast with that and Disco Inferno, he's harmless. As I've said before, as long as he never actually was given a booking job somewhere and allowed to do the stupid ideas and stupid things that he comes up with as relates to wrestling, the Invisible Man and Bill Ding, the Evil Architect and whatever. he's gotten a job for the past 10 or 15 years because he's from New York and Russo likes to have his own kind around him and likes, Disco's tomfoolery. Amuses him, and they hired him as an agent one time in TNA, and none of the boys fucking respected him, and they used to fuck with him unmercifully, but he was there as he was like Cheetah in the Tarzan movies. But even Disco Inferno, under those parameters, on this program that Vince Russo does allegedly for somebody, I'm not going to plug it, nobody should watch it or listen to it, but if Disco's a co-host or whatever, and he's on there, and Russo came out and told people, admitted from his own two fucking measly little lips, that not only when TNA was on Destination America, he had contacted the Destination America, the network behind Dixie Carter's back, and told them, well, you've been sold a bill of goods, and you this program you're getting is not what you're thinking you're going to get, and you need me to tell you how to do it right and straighten it out for you. And that Danny was basically trying to suck somebody's dick for a job, which is probably the job he's going to end up with shortly when he keeps stooging himself. And then he did the same thing to Pop TV. He's done the same thing at Brad Schwartz at Pop TV. He got a hold of him and said, hey, you've been sold a bill of goods. This program's crummy. I'm the only one that can fix it. You need to hire me as a consultant, so I'll help you out. Trying to basically tell the networks that are carrying TNA, if you can call Pop TV a network at this point, but trying to tell the platforms that TNA has left available to them to stay on the air that this program's a shit, nobody's going to watch it, you've been sold a bill of goods. That was a quote. You've been sold a bill of goods, and the only way to fix it is if you hire me, not thinking that they may just say, well, fuck, now that this guy's told us we just got conned by this fucking lying douchebag twat Dixie Carter and a bunch of these other wrestling carnies, why don't we just cancel the whole thing and everybody'd be out of a job. He didn't care about that. All he wanted to do was go behind somebody's back and get a job. And I hate to say, Brian, you know how bad I hate to say I told you so.
You do?
Every time I say I told you so, I preface it by saying I hate to say this. So you know it's true. But people, I told you so. He's a fucking lying, backstabbing, nut-cutting, jock-sniffing, conniving motherfucker that doesn't give a fuck about anybody but himself, much like Donald Trump. Because that's because in his little fucking pea brain, in that dehydrated BB that he calls a functioning fucking brain, Vince Russo still thinks, despite all evidence to the contrary, he still thinks that he knows the first fucking thing, that he can spell cat if you spot him the C and the A as it comes to professional wrestling. He had a momentary bit of success due to as much as a billionaire's fucking desperation and complete accident, and also falling, tripping over the two biggest stars in the modern history of the business. And he has traded on that for 20 years by lying, by conniving, by going behind people's backs. And we're gonna sketch that whole thing out for you, as a matter of fact. Because at first manifested itself when he went down there and was fighting with after he gave notice to Vince McMahon by calling him on the phone when Vince had just landed from a European tour and was at the Meadowlands, despite the fact that that was 30 miles from where Vince Russo lived and he could have easily hopped in his car and in an hour he could have been standing looking Vince McMahon in the face and saying, "I'm taking a better offer in WCW. Here's my hand, Vince. Thank you for getting me started in the business, and I owe everything to you," because he did. He was running a fucking secondhand goddamn video store before Vince McMahon had a momentary lapse of insanity and hired him. Instead of doing that, he called him on the phone and gave him his notice. And I don't think Vince McMahon, he may not have seen him again to this day in person. That was the kind of stand-up guy he was. Then he goes down to Turner Broadcasting, where he'd sold them a bill of goods, just like Bischoff did, to fucking get the job that he had at that time. He said, "I'm responsible for the Attitude Era. It was all me. It wasn't Steve Austin. It wasn't The Rock. It wasn't Jim Ross, the greatest announcer of all time. It wasn't a network-quality television production facility. It was all me and this fucking stooge named Ed Ferrara, this fat, dumpy, pasty-faced fuck that carries my papers around. We're the ones." So they gave him an incredible amount of money to come down there and save their fucking sinking ship until, I don't even know if the first time was 6 months, they realized, oh, shit, this guy don't know what the fuck he's doing. And think about when WCW under Turner Broadcasting and Eric Bischoff at that time said, "Oh, my fucking God, this guy don't know what the fuck he's doing." Imagine how fucking incompetent that guy must have been. And they sent him home, and then he came back and tried to work with Bischoff, and then he went home again, and then he said he had a concussion, and he took his ball and went home because he was in the ring, this fucking buggy-whipped arm, bug-eyed, non-athletic fuck was in the ring trying to, on a national television show, trying to play wrestler and doing it badly. Out of the 2 or 2.5 years that he spent in WCW until they sent him home for the final time and closed down shortly thereafter, he closed down a fucking billionaire's wrestling company. He wasn't in charge half of the time, and he blamed standards and practices, and he blamed this guy, and he blamed that guy, and only if they'd seen my true vision, and only if they'd seen my true brilliance, right? So that was his fucking success in WCW. And then after WCW goes out of business and is sold to Vince McMahon, after losing $60 million in the last year of their existence, and sold to Vince McMahon for basically pennies on a dollar, where does Vince Russo end up? Jerry Jarrett starts a company with his son out of Nashville, had original investors. The investors at the time looked good, but unfortunately they got in some problems with their own business. It was hell south. Everybody's heard that story. But Jeff Jarrett, unfortunately, the one mistake that the Jarrett family made, or Jeff at least, was trusting this fucking conniving shit. And he's the one, Vince Russo's the one, everybody knows this story is true, that named TNA Wrestling. And Jerry Jarrett, he lied to Jerry Jarrett and said, "Oh, it's total nonstop action." And Jerry was not sold on the fucking name, but of course Russo admitted later on, "I just told him that because he would have never gone for it. It was really TNA, because in his fucking adolescent, never fucked another fucking female, but his childhood sweetheart, who he's still married to, fucking arrested sexual fucking life, That was a fucking funny thing. Oh, let's make it TNA wrestling. That'll get all the fucking people that watch the Jerry Springer show, like me and my fucking butt buddy Ed Ferrara that carries my papers around. We consider that highbrow entertainment. That's the fucking opera, the Jerry Springer show. All wrestling fans want to see is trash. We want to appeal to the lowest common denominator. So he named a company TNA Wrestling. And believe me, it wasn't lost on people outside the wrestling bubble. I remember when I promoted one of their first live events here in Louisville, Kentucky, I had to go to the cable company and I had to go to the television companies. I had to go to the radio stations and say, yes, I'm working for, and I would say it very slowly, TNA Wrestling. But still they go, oh, TNA Wrestling, and roll their fucking eyes. So this fucking little adolescent fucking jock-sniffing wannabe fucking wrestler who thought he was a goddamn genius doomed them with a bad name that people wouldn't take seriously. The creative was suspect for the first couple of years when they got sideways with Hell South because they had their legal issues and couldn't put any more money in it. They found Dixie Carter. They found an angel, as my old friend Bert Prentice would say. And he went right to work on Dixie Carter. Oh, I know exactly what I'm doing. Oh, I'm the greatest. Oh, it's just that everybody else is, there's a problem. Everybody else, they're holding me back. Everybody else. And they fired him once. They let him go, fired him. I don't know what the fuck. I wasn't there then. The reason why I went to TNA originally was because I thought it was a Russo free zone because they had already made that experiment and saw that it didn't work. And he had midgets beaten off in garbage cans and dancers in cages. Vince Russo was responsible for Jeff and Jerry Jarrett not speaking to each other for years because of the ill feelings, because of Vince Russo being involved in that when Jerry Jarrett was trying to start a wrestling company and had, and his quote in one of his books was reading a television format written by Vince Russo was like reading something written by a man on LSD. And Jeff, unfortunately, and we'll talk about this, folks, he came to find out, but he didn't know then Russo's true colors. So as a result of Jeff still trying to follow the sports entertainment thing that Russo wanted to put together, Jerry and Jeff didn't speak for years. He tore a family apart because of his backstabbing and whispering in people's ears and telling people things behind other people's backs. So he did that, but he was in Dixie Carter's ear. And then he was gone, but then he was always in her ear because then, see, here's the thing. This fucking guy, even though he says he graduated fucking college, and by the way, Russo, I know you're going to listen to this because you listen to everything that everybody says about you. You've blocked me on Twitter. I don't have your fucking phone number, but I just want you to know when you listen to this motherfucker, you know I'm telling the God's honest truth. You're God, the one you believe in. I don't, but I'm not a liar like you are. I don't suck up to people to get a job. If they don't want to fucking hire me on my merits, they can go piss up a rope. So I'm telling the truth because I got nothing to lose. And if you got anything to say to me, you call me. You know people that have my fucking number, you piece of shit. So here's what happens next. I think it's a Russo free zone, but he's still in Dixie Carter's ear because he knows nothing else. He can't do anything else. He went to college over in Evansville, Indiana for journalism, and he can't fucking spell. And he was a goddamn embarrassment when we used to read the TV formats in the TNA production meetings, and the Spike TV representative would be sitting there. I knew he was going back to the UFC folks and the people at Spike going, yeah, this fucking idiot that fucking writes the wrestling show, he can't even spell. He doesn't even know the right words to use. It's a goddamn joke. So anyway, he's still in Dixie's ear. So I come in to work with Dutch Mantel and Jeff Jarrett in 2006. And a couple months later, Dutch Mantel calls me and says, well, we fired a couple people off the creative team. I think Scott D'Amore was one. Maybe somebody else, I can't remember, but we hired somebody new. I said, who's that? Vince Russo. And I was dumbfounded. I said, why the fuck? What the fuck can you explain this to me? And I will say to Dutch Mantel's credit, he's one of the funniest and the smartest men I've ever met in professional wrestling. And for 3 years on a weekly basis, I would ask him, why is this motherfucker here? Why is his presence tolerated? Why is anybody listening to him? He could never give me a fucking answer because he didn't know either. But I tried to give my notice because I didn't want to be, I knew it was going to be a situation. I didn't want to be a detriment to business. I said, hey, when you guys smarten up and fucking fire him, then call me back. Let Abyss give me the black hole slam. Jeff wouldn't accept my notice. He said, nope. If you don't come, you're not showing up. We're not going to take it. We're not going to take your resignation. You don't have to deal with Russo. Dutch is your producer. You go on, blah, blah, blah. So there's a little email. And I said, fine. I said, I tried to give my notice. I don't want it to get in the way of business. You know how I feel about this guy, but I will do my best for you, Jeff. If you want me to be here, I will do my best for you. I will perform my best. I will do my best for the company. As a matter of fact, it was 3 months later, 4 months later, Jeff asked me to be not only an on-air talent as commissioner, but also an agent to help work in the TV truck and tell, like, Keith Mitchell, the producer, and Dave Sahadi or Timmy Walbert, the directors, what was going on so they didn't miss any shots, especially on the live pay-per-views, and lay out matches for the guys, especially the ex-WWF talent that might want to work with someone that had a little bit more experience than a few of the other agents that they had. And I accepted that job because I wanted to help the company. And I never had any of fucking confrontations with Russo. I didn't speak to him for the first 3 months. I didn't have any confrontations with him. I didn't cause any problems. I said, okay, I will help do what I can for the company. What did Vince Russo do? What did he think in his mind? There was a lawsuit that Conan brought against TNA Wrestling, and one of the emails that was discovery in that lawsuit was pertaining to me. And Brian, I sent it to you because I wanted you to see it. Instead of me just reading this shit and everybody thinks it's me, you can vouch for the fact that this is a legitimate email that was found in discovery in the lawsuit that was sent by Vince Russo to Dixie Carter. Can you not?
I can. I can verify that's exactly what it is.
Can you read that email now?
I can. I believe this came up because David Bixenspan, my partner on 605, was doing an article about this and uncovered this. It's about Conan's discrimination lawsuit against TNA. I believe in that lawsuit, he also accused Terry Taylor of causing his kidney failure by giving him pills. But anyway, here is the letter. I'll read it verbatim as best as I can. It is from October 12th, 2006.
About three or five, I would say, no, it's about a month after they hired Russo back.
Dixie. There are two things I want to pass along to you regarding a conversation I had this morning. A good friend of mine that I worked with at the WWF for four years, called me today. His name is Matt Miller, and he now runs the Gund Arena in Cleveland. Matt told me that a couple of weeks ago he caught part of our show after watching the UFC. He said that he felt we were sending out mixed messages, that the pieces didn't seem to fit. He said on one hand he saw Conan's group, LAX, that came across as cool, hip, and cutting edge. And moments later, he saw Jim Cornette on the same show that came across as a Southern 1980s wrestling cartoon. Dixie, these were his exact words. I agree wholeheartedly with this and tried to tiptoe around it with Jeff, and he got defensive and mad at me. Right now, in Samoa Joe and Kurt, we have two wrestlers about as real as can be. The closest to UFC that you're going to get. Then on the other hand, we have your Cornettes and your Jeffs to some extent.
To some extent in parentheses. Yeah.
That are about as old school wrestling as you get. It seems that in 42 minutes, we have two different brands, two different types of entertainment. My thing with Cornette isn't personal. I swear to you. And that's in caps. That's why I said swear like that.
Yeah.
But I'm just having a huge problem with him representing TNA management, wearing a canary yellow sports jacket when we go into prime time. Again, Dixie, being hip is the key. Joe is cool. Angle is cool. LAX, you have guys like Truth and Hoyt. And then we shot ourselves in the foot when we go back 20 years. Again, I just wanted to make note of this. To be honest, if I was writing TV, a character like Jim Cornette would not be representing TNA management. I would rather go with an attractive, sexy female executive like a Tina Fey that would add a whole new dimension to the product. Just my two cents. Business. Matt also told me that the owners of the Cleveland Cavaliers own a company called Fatheads. What they make is huge decals of athletes that you could stick on your wall. They tried to strike a deal with the WWF and were turned down. This might be worth our while to go after, as I think it would be a good thing to get our licensing department on. If they want any more info, they can call me. I hope you're having a good day. Peace, Vince.
Number one, Matt Miller. I know Matt Miller very well. Matt Miller is a friend of mine. I also worked with him at the same time in the WWF, and he was a very nice guy, and he never seemed to have a problem with me. And I don't know whether Matt Miller said that or whether Vince just needed to come up with somebody else that said these things so he could agree with them rather than it coming from him, since obviously he had nothing personal against me. But you see, he started a month after they hired him back. Jeff Jarrett at that time was still a minority owner of TNA, and he is going to Dixie telling Dixie that Jeff, the guy, the only reason that he got involved, Russo got involved with the company to begin with, Jeff Jarrett, was Southern wrestling. And then he tried to walk it back a little bit by saying to some extent, he tried to walk it back, but me, he wasn't going to walk back. By the way, do you remember ever seeing me wearing a canary yellow suit in TNA?
I don't actually, no.
No, because I didn't. Because here, Fuckwad wasn't even paying attention to what was going on his own show, on the show that for the company he was working for. Dutch Mantel is the one who decided that I was going to be, actually, he wanted to call me the wrestling czar, but I was either, I can't remember whether I was director of authority or voice of management or whatever the fuck. It was the old commissioner thing, the old commissioner ploy. But I was wearing double-breasted suits that matched and was the only one in the whole company and maybe the only one in the whole business with the verbal ability, as was tested and proven many times, as Dutch and Jeff would actually come to me and say, you got to explain this. You're the only one's going to be able to get these rules out or these stipulations or explain what the fuck. I was racking my brain trying to go out there and explain the foolishness and the nonsense and the verbal effluvia that Vince Russo was writing that nobody would understand, and I had to go out and make sense out of it. And I was dressed, I thought, quite well. I looked to myself when I looked in the mirror like a paragon of sartorial resplendency. I bought nice suits. Everything matched. I wasn't carrying a tennis racket. I was the voice of the promotion. And unfortunately, the voice of the promotion is the one that had to explain the bullshit that Vince Russo was foisting off on the viewers. Then he would, instead of me doing that, can you name Tina Fey, by the way, was not available. Not for those wages, at least. Can you imagine a woman that was going to be able to explain any of that horse shit? Can you imagine it? I, at one point, not only had to explain all the horse shit that he was writing, but also there was at one point, I know some of the three or four TNA fans might remember, that the production crew was ready to riot because he came into the production meeting wanting to have a brawl involving 32 members of the roster fighting simultaneously in three different places, inside the impact zone, in the locker room area, and out in catering, and wanted it shot live to tape. And I was the one they came to and was able to produce that because I spent 4 hours that afternoon placing everybody, placing the furniture, placing the toys, and walking everybody through it, not only from the wrestling side, but also from the camera side. I gave the best effort that I could give to try to mitigate the damage that he was doing to that lying cunt Dixie Carter's fucking company, by trying to at least bring it back up to even, because I figured if I do the best I can, then maybe, just maybe, I can mitigate the damage he's doing and we can at least break even on the thing. Of course, I was overestimating my fucking capabilities because I wasn't even that good. But already a month after that they hired him back, he was sending emails like that, knocking me personally, knocking Jeff behind his back. I remember another time that Dutch Mantel mentioned that he was at Jeff's house and he and Vince and Jeff were writing the show. And Dutch was out of the room, and this was right after he come back, and he couldn't hear exactly what was going on, but he heard a few little choice things because Russo was whining and griping and squealing like a pig under a gate that I hated him and he didn't know what was going to happen. And I've told him in the past, I was going to punch him in the face. And Jeff Jarrett's words loud and clear rang out, "God damn it, Vince. If you're so fucking worried about it, why don't you go ahead and have the fight with him and be a man and see what happens?" And he wouldn't fucking do it because he's a gutless prick. He's a gutless backstabbing prick. So what did he do then? He waited 3 years. He waited until Jeff got sideways with Dixie, and Dixie sent Jeff home and removed him from power. And then he saw his chance to whisper in the ear of that delicate little Southern flower that had wasted about $50 million at that point of her father's money. And he systematically got everybody that Jeff had brought in to run the wrestling side of the equation except himself out. First, Savio Vega was fired as an agent. Then Road Dogg, Brian Armstrong, Brian James was fired as an agent. Then finally, Dutch Mantel, who not only had 40 years experience in professional wrestling, but had more talent for wrestling in his little finger than Vince Russo has ever had in his giant bloated fucking body with that basketball-sized head on top of that fucking pea-sized fucking neck. But also, Dutch Mantel is the one, as Vince Russo said, we have Samoa Joe and Kurt Angle that are real can be. That's the UFC. Vince Russo never watched a bit of the UFC. Russo plays fantasy baseball like he lives in a fantasy world. It was Dutch Mantel, the one that wrote the TVs, that was the lead up to the biggest pay-per-view that they ever did, which was Samoa Joe and Kurt Angle in that semi-shoot fight. It was Dutch Mantel that made the decision that they wouldn't do angles every week, that they would just train and talk about each other. So people would have to pay to see them touch. And as a result, TNA Wrestling did 40-some thousand pay-per-view buys for that pay-per-view, the most they'd ever done, and they never approached it again because Russo saw that success and figured, oh, shit, I didn't have anything to do with this, so I better start booking these fucking guys because elsewise, if they do it again and I don't have anything to do with it, even Dixie, as stupid as she is, will see through it. So that's when he took over fucking taking care of them. And as a result, they never achieved that success again because all he did was his phony angles every week. When the knockouts became the highest rated segment of the show, it had been girl wrestling that Vince Russo didn't want anything to do with. So Dutch Mantel, building around Gail Kim, a classic Ricky Morton babyface, and Awesome Kong, a classic Abdullah the Butcher-style heel, built the knockouts division into where it was doing better ratings than the men that Russo was writing. So then Russo takes over with the beautiful people and blah, 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 and gimmicked the knockouts up and just made them part of the roster again, and they lost their success. And then finally, when Jeff was sent home, and then he got rid of Savio, and he got rid of Road Dogg, and then finally he got rid of Dutch, then I was the last one to go. Because allegedly, I had blown up at Vince Russo in a production meeting. Now, let me tell you folks something, and I'm pretty sure you know when I'm telling the truth. If I had screamed and yelled at Vince Russo and cussed him out, don't you think I would be saying that? Don't you think I would be broadcasting that from the highest rooftop in the land? What happened was he booked a stupid match between Sting and Hernandez, supposed to be Super Mex, supposed to be Dixie's Latino superstar, both of them baby faces, Sting 20 years older and a fucking 60 pounds lighter. And Sting was supposed to have broken ribs from a previous attack on the show. And then they were going to have this match with each other on TV, and a bunch of people were going to run in. They were going to fight them off together, and then Sting was going to roll Hernandez up from behind and beat him. So the 50-year-old man with the broken ribs was going to beat the Latino superstar that everybody knows you don't beat the Latino superstars because their people lose faith in them. And besides that, it was preposterous. And besides that, it would turn Sting heel. And then he was going to have Eric Young come down and lay both of them out with a baseball bat and stand there and cut a promo over them, even though neither Eric Young nor most of the people that were going to run in were even on the next pay-per-view, but Sting and Hernandez were both on the next pay-per-view in very prominent matches. And in the production meeting, privately, I said, what the fuck? Because the one time since 1999 that Vince Russo has called me on the phone, he had called me on my way down to Florida. And he had told me that this match he had was going to take place like that. And I said, Vince, that's insane for all the reasons I just mentioned. You can't do that. It'll bury everybody. Let them fight the opposing forces off together and do a DQ and get out of it. A DQ may not be preferable, but we're in it now because you shouldn't have the match to begin with. And he said, okay, you're right. And as soon as we got to the production meeting, he had changed that back to the original thing. So with Terry Taylor there and with Taz there and with Mike Tenay there, and with everybody else that was in the office at the time, we argued it out, and I prevailed because my way made sense and didn't destroy the careers of their top stars. And then I went out as the agent and executed that. I didn't go into business for myself. We got the okay first. Then, just a few weeks later, I get a call from Terry Taylor announcing that my services are no longer required, along with Dutch's, along with Savio's, along with Road Dogs, along with every other fucking enemy that he had. The only people that remained were Matt Conway, who was some stooge that had worked in production that Dixie put on the creative team because they wouldn't tell her what was going on, and so she wanted somebody to fucking spy for her, and Russo, and he was about to bring in Ed Ferrara, who I had told what I thought of him years ago and who wouldn't coexist with me, so he had to figure out a way to get me out of the way. So he cut my nuts off behind my back to Dixie and Terry Taylor, because Terry, my old friend, I never hated him. He flunked a stooge test when I sent an email to him about Russo, but he had no balls, and he was a Christian buddy of Russo's, and they rode in the car together. Have you ever noticed these Christian buddies? They don't mind lying behind people's backs. Terry Taylor took up for him and called me and said, fine, your services are no longer required. Then the next day, I read on the internet that it's announced in the Sun newspaper that I was fired for being unprofessional, for having a blow up and in the production meeting and screaming, why are we pushing Eric Young? Which was nonsense and had to come from somebody in that room. And it was a preemptive strike by that piece of shit, lying sack of snake feces, Vince Russo, to make him look like the baby face. I had to do something wrong. And people would think, they would believe readily that I would scream at Vince Russo, even though I hadn't. So I asked Terry Taylor, my old bosom buddy, for a retraction, since he knew that it didn't happen. And he said that he was sure that Dixie would have no problem with that. And the next day, there was a retraction. The same unnamed source that said I did it also said I didn't do it. Not from Dixie Carter, not from anybody that was attributable in the company, but an unnamed source. Which is why that I've been telling people what a lying sack of shit, whore, cunt, douchebag Dixie Carter's been ever since, because she lied to me to my face on the phone and told me it didn't have anything to do with Russo. It was just a difference in philosophy, and we'd work together sometime again down the road. Yeah, I'd want some more of that. It was so enjoyable the first time around. And I've also tried to tell everybody what Vince Russo's really like. But unfortunately, even though most everybody now knows, since he has had not one lick of success in the fucking wrestling industry since his accidental attitude era 20 years ago, he still perpetuates this myth that he could say suey if the hogs had him about professional wrestling. And the only one now that believes him is that fucking douchebag Dixie Carter, because even after they brought in Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff, by the way, how much success has TNA Wrestling had since the summer of 2009 after Jeff Jarrett left and I left and Dutch Mantel left? Things have pretty much gone downhill. They've had every big name from Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff on down, and their ratings have gotten worse, and their television networks have plummeted from Spike to fucking Destination America to fucking Pop TV. Their talent roster has been depleted. Her parents cut her off, Brian, cut off her allowance, the little delicate Southern flower, so she don't have the money to play wrestling promoter anymore. She's Ann Gunkel in the dying days of the Georgia War. So they bring in Bischoff and Hogan, who hate Vince Russo just as much as most everybody. There's been lawsuits between them before, and Russo loses his power, so he goes home. But he knew that Bischoff and Hogan were just drying the fucking clueless twat out, hanging her up and draining her blood, and he knew that she would need something sooner or later. So he waited, and when finally she realized that she had been butt-fucked by Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff without even any lube, she started talking to Vince Russo again. And he became a consultant to her. But you see, here's the problem. See, he's so toxic, his presence is so poisonous, his reputation is so bad, and everybody who's ever worked with him, if they'll admit it publicly, knows what the fuck he's like, that she couldn't even bring him back in front of people. So he was a consultant in secret. And then you remember this, Brian. Who stooged on him? He did. He sent an email not to Mike Tenay telling him how to do some commentary, but to Mike Johnson of PW Insider, who they had denied and lied to, like they'd lied to everybody else, said, no, Vince Russo doesn't have anything to do with our company. And that proved it did. And Mike Johnson asked for a comment, and they lied to him again, and he got mad because they lied to him, so he printed it. And guess who else didn't want Vince Russo involved in the company? Spike TV, who already wasn't happy with the ratings that they weren't getting anymore from that half-ass outlaw program. And they had told the Spike TV representative specifically when they asked, no, Vince Russo doesn't have anything to do with our company. So not only did they find out by reading the internet that a company that they had been helping to financially support, that they had been kicking in money for to pay the big contracts of all these big stars that they'd brought in to diminishing returns and falling ratings, but then the douchebag owner of the company had lied to them about it, and it wasn't a program that they needed to keep to begin with, so they canceled their ass. And she still didn't fucking learn. She, of course, she had to distance herself from him at that point, right? She had to distance herself, but I understand they've still talked a time or two, and she still won't come out and knock him publicly. So then she fell from Spike TV to Destination America. And that didn't work out, because maybe because this fucking backstabbing, no good cunt, Vince Russo, was calling up Destination America going, well, you got sold a bill of goods. I'm the one, and they don't know anything about wrestling. Obviously, they wouldn't have put TNA on in the first place if they did. But they probably figured, well, this guy, he's worked for all these big companies. He must know what he's talking about. We don't want to hire him as a consultant. We'll just get him. He probably got them bounced off Destination America. Don't you think that happened suspiciously quickly, that they exercised the out clause in their contract so quickly? And then they go to Pop TV, which was recently rebranded from the TV Guide channel and probably has about as many viewers as C-SPAN, and he does the same fucking thing. Here's the loyalty of that no-good piece of fucking shit, that the only person that has even wanted to or tried to employ him in the wrestling business in the past 15 years, the only one that would listen to his horse shit, the only one who would put up with his presence, the only one who would spend millions of dollars of her father and mother's money in a losing effort just because he put them in a hole so bad like George W. Bush did this country that they could never recover. He went behind her back too, because that's the kind of guy that he is. And Jeff Jarrett finally found out, because when once that he was gone, he found out that Vince was knocking him too. Which is why Vince Russo, he's already tried to get a job with Lucha Underground, because I mentioned he doesn't know anything else to do except running bad fucking B-movie fucking video stores, and those are not exactly, might as well run a buggy whip factory these days than run a video store. So now he tried to get on with Lucha Underground. They were smart enough not to take him. Tried to get on with Destination America. They were smart enough not to take him. Tried to get on with even Pop TV wouldn't take him. Pop fucking TV. You might as well be showing slides on the wall of a barn in Wartburg, Tennessee as being on Pop TV, and they wouldn't take him. He's fucking toxic. He's poisonous. And now, once again, he's stooged himself. He's the only guy in the world that ever quit from his own website, if you remember that from about a year ago, because the fucking guy that he got into the website business with, he fucked that guy and forgot to get all his passwords first. He was telling people not to buy his own merchandise off of his own website. It's the only time in the world I've ever agreed with Vince Russo was when he told people not to buy his merchandise. He's a complete fucking idiot. If brains were gasoline, he couldn't propel a flea's motorcycle around a raindrop. If you took Vince Russo's brain and you bowled it toward a drinking straw, it would look like you were rolling a kernel of corn into a storm drain. So now, maybe everybody will realize, and by the way, the video of the podcast where he announced he stooged himself that he had done this, as soon as everybody realized what he'd done, including himself, and it was up on all the sites, he took it down. Sorry, this video does not exist, because even he in his minuscule little fucking vapid brain realized that he had made himself once again look like the fucking idiot and the conniving backstabber that he is. So, ladies and gentlemen, I hate to say I told you so, but I've been saying this for 20 years, and now more than ever, people understand and people know, and thank you, Vince Russo. I've never said those words before, but thank you from the bottom of my pea-picking little heart, because you yourself, Vince Russo, are the one that has proved what I've been saying all along. You're a piece of shit. You're a liar, you're a con man, you're a backstabber, and you cut people's nuts off behind their back instead of looking them straight in the face. And the words that I said, and I will close the program with this, the words that I said to Jim Ross in 1999, when I left Stamford, Connecticut, and I came to Louisville to oversee OVW, I told Jim Ross in his office at Titan Tower, I said, JR, I certainly hope that Vince McMahon likes this idea that we have for taking the developmental property to OVW. I think I can do a good job with it. I'm excited about the prospects, because we didn't know whether or not Vince was going to do it. I said, but I just want you to know, just from me to you, because we've been friends for, at that time, 15 years. If I leave this town without a job with the WWF, I'm going to hospitalize Vince Russo my last day here. And he, oh, Corny, don't do that. I said, no. I've had enough. I can't stand his existence in the world anymore, and I'm going to do something about it. And fortunately for him, I left with a job. And then it was in TNA when he pulled that little deal. I was right there in front of him. As a matter of fact, I told Jeff Jarrett, this is the only heat I ever had with Jeff Jarrett. I told Jeff Jarrett, I said, good rib. Because for 3 years we've coexisted, and I've said hello, Vince, in the production meetings, but we've never had a casual conversation, and I still feel the same way, but I was willing to be professional and work with the guy. But finally, when Jeff was gone, and Dutch was gone, and Savio was gone, and Road Dogg was gone, Jeff Jarrett called me one day on the phone. He said, please, basically, take care of my business. He said, you're the last one left. You know he'll go too far. I said, and why'd you have anything to do with hiring him in the first place, Jeff? And he couldn't give me an answer. But he said, just try to keep him from going too far. Work with the boys, because I always have to get with the boys and get them to do the stupid shit he wanted them to do. So then I'd have to change it around to where it'd be something that they would do and then go to Jeff and get it approved. So Jeff says, take care of my business, Jim. And I said, all right, I will. And in the spirit of that, before that production meeting happened where we had that little discussion, I took Vince Russo around the corner in Universal Studios back there in the offices, and I stuck my hand out. I said, I know we've had our business. We're never going to agree about wrestling, but the team is in need, and we're the only two now that are going to be able to work together. I'll keep the boys on the right path, and you try to fucking do whatever the fuck it is you do. I didn't say that. I was nice. And I shook his fucking hand. Shook his fucking hand. It was a 3-year rib by Jeff Jarrett just to get me to shake his fucking hand. And then 2 weeks later, of course, I'm out. But I was out on the phone. I wasn't anywhere around him. And I haven't been within 1,000 miles, as far as I know, of Vince Russo since then. And as a matter of fact, WrestleCade this year in Winston-Salem, I've been the guest general manager and appeared at the convention. I'm not going to be doing that this year. I had a standing invitation from the promoters, Tim Woody and Tracy Myers, and they do a great show, and I recommend everybody go. But I won't be there this year because one of the vendors is bringing Vince Russo in. And I had promised Stacy a long time ago and promised myself that I would never be in the same place as him ever again, because I know how I get. And I know that one of us would go to jail and the other one would go to the hospital. And I believe I know which is which, and I don't want to be paying any lawyers. So I'm not going to be there at WrestleCade this year, specifically because I'm trying to be the bigger man and not get in fucking issues. But now that he has come out and told everybody, told the world what a piece of shit he is, I am just congratulating myself that once again, I've known all along and for 20 years what I've been saying is true. And Vince Russo, let me tell you something. And if you want to, you can call the fucking FBI, because I sent Terry Taylor an email about him one time. And Terry Taylor immediately forwarded it right to Russo. And I didn't say I was going to murder him, but I said I sure would like to, that I have dreams about doing it. And they sent me a letter from their lawyers. It was, by the way, it was an entertainment lawyer. God never even fucking tried a real fucking criminal case. Couldn't got a sodomy charge reduced to tailgating with some entertainment lawyer. But they said, you violated a confidentiality contract. And I've still framed this part. And Vince Russo's in mortal fear of you. Well, Russo, you better be in mortal fear of me, son, because I'm old and I'm broke down and I don't know if I can whip anybody anymore. But I swear to fucking God in heaven, if there was one, that the next time that I see you anywhere in person, I will pick up whatever blunt instrument is handy, and I will do what I've been wanting to do for 20 years, and that's cave your miserable fucking skull in and do the world a favor. So I'm being the bigger man at WrestleCade, and I'm pulling out, and I ain't going to be there, because he even told the guy was trying to book him. He said, Cornette's going to be there, and I'm scared of Cornette. Well, you don't have to worry about it, Vince. I'm giving you a free pass. But son, the next turn's up to you, because the next time, I'm not going to cost myself and my family money again. I'm not going to pull out of another one. Next time, it's your turn to pull out. Or else, that's what your father should have done, by the way, son. Or you can just come on, being the pussy that you are, you can come on and your knees can knock together like Jose Greco's backup band. And you and me will be in the same place sometime again, and we'll see what fucking happens. And if I've been to jail before, you never have, because you told me yourself 20 years ago you'd never been in a fucking fight in your life. I've had people wanted to kill me on top of me, and I'm still standing here. So let's see what two old, broke-down, middle-aged white fucks can do. It might look like Kimbo Slice and Dot of 5,000, but no, one of these days, Vince, it's going to come down to it, and everybody wants to know what's going to happen, and I sure do. I know you don't. But in the meantime, I can take pleasure and privilege in the fact that everything I've ever said about you was true, and it's been proven from your own two measly lying little lips. And for that, I think that's about time to end the show today. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've had as much fun as I have over the last couple minutes. We will be back next week with another experience. Until then, for our producer, Styles Bitchley, for my co-host, the great Brian Last, and for that piece of shit, Vince Russo, that I hope is somewhere in Colorado preparing to hang himself in his fucking closet, I bid you a good day.